That's multi-instrumentalist Rahsaan Roland Kirk with Scott Joplin's The Entertainer, retitled by Rahsaan Roland Kirk as The Entertainer Done in the Style of the Blues. It's from his 1975 album, The Case of the Three-Sided Dream in Audio Color. Yes, that's the title of the album. And he performs on tenor sax, clarinet, flute, and trumpet, and he also arranged the album. Rahsaan Roland Kirk died after suffering a stroke 2 years later in 1977. He was just 42 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today, a kind of philosophical discussion. But first, let's talk about some updates. And this update is about the Justice Department supposedly reaching a deal with the city of Ferguson, Missouri's police department. And remember, after the shooting death by Officer Darren Wilson of Michael Brown, there was a great outcry. And the Justice Department came in and said, well, what this city really needs is a study. And we need to look at how the police department functions in the city of Ferguson, Missouri. And Eric Holder, the then U.S. Attorney General, conducted a study. And the study revealed a number of things about the Justice Department that needed to be revamped, clearly found patterns and practices based on race that basically put the predominantly African-American population of Ferguson at a great disadvantage. And so the study led to corrective action. And this was supposed to be the crux of the whole thing. There was no intention at all of looking toward prosecuting anybody. And that remains the standing policy today, even as there is a new U.S. Attorney General, Loretta Lynch. But Eric Holder basically walked out the door just when one thought that, well, the study should be yielding a little bit more, but he walked out just as he completed the study and left it, I guess, to his successor to figure out how else to implement it. Well, I raise this because what the study did do, you know, it raised the issues that had been known for many, many years in Ferguson. It simply quantified them. But it didn't do anything about delivering justice. What it did was urge that the police department of Ferguson, Missouri, function more efficiently in the way it relates to the African-American community. And at the time that the study was done, it was hailed as a major inroad. And I guess the announcement that the city of Ferguson has entered into a consent decree with the Justice Department to follow its instructions on administrative reforms is being hailed as a landmark progress. Okay, well, I disagree. I believe that we still are falling far short here of what the Justice Department should have been delivering, especially in the aftermath of such a blatant case of police abuse of power and authority and use of lethal force. I still think the Justice Department should do what it's supposed to do, which is deliver justice. It intends not to do so. And lest anybody believe that I'm just speaking blindly here, just being negative, I have a previous consent decree, the one that the Justice Department worked out and the City of Cleveland Police Department to refer to now say that the consent decree worked out with the department, the police department in Ferguson, is following exactly the same template as that worked out in the City of Cleveland. And we discussed just earlier this week, and we discussed last week, cases that glaringly indicate abuse of authority and power and use of lethal force by members of the Cleveland Police Department in several cases. We discussed them right here. But the position of the Justice Department in those cases when it worked out this consent decree just last year with the Cleveland Police Department, or the Cleveland Division of Police, as it formerly is called, the same department continued to kill people, and with apparent impunity, and with the Justice Department taking a hands-off position about it. They're not interested in prosecuting anybody. In fact, Loretta Lynch had made it very clear. I shared her speech with you, a speech at the news conference, in which she said that the purpose of the review by the Justice Department is purely administrative. They have no intention of pursuing the prosecution of anyone. And so we have a continuum of neglect and intentional neglect by the federal government, and a dereliction of duty, it seems to me, because it knowingly permits illegalities to continue. We have seen in the cases we've discussed here with Alton Maddox, we have seen the consistent pattern of prosecutorial misconduct. We have seen the flouting of the law by the police. And we have seen in the City of Cleveland that the City of Cleveland used taxpayer money to assist two police officers who were ordered by a federal jury and by an appellate court to pay a victim of wrongful prosecution and wrongful conviction, and who had served almost 12 full years of a life sentence for a murder he did not commit, and they knew it. We saw that the Justice Department's position was, and still is, that police officers routinely get a back door through which to make their exit from justice. So while some people are taking this as a great step forward, I wish to remind folks that we have context for these things. And when you have a context for these things, and it says almost prescient, it's almost as if we anticipated these developments because we were ahead of them, we explain to you how the Justice Department had basically abandoned its duty, and with impunity. So much for that. But what I want to talk about today is the radicalized right. Yes, I use that word radicalized because it's been used so often and directed at a particular group of people who, the thinking is, who should not mind being discussed this way, because it is meant to indicate that there's something wrong with their thinking, something deeply offensive and wrong. It's the way that the media and the political power structure routinely refer to Muslims, to other people who oppose government, and who oppose standing policy of any sort. It's the term they use to basically address the issue of extremism. People are radicalized. So I think it is appropriate. It's an appropriate word to discuss the radicalized right. These are people who have become extremists, extreme fundamentalists, about the guiding philosophy of this country. And they see a need to dedicate themselves with unquestionable fervor to returning us all to that point in time that is at the formation of the nation, and since then, the continuum, to the so-called American values that are routinely held up and extolled, and so far, just about everybody is doing it in this political season. There's so many American values, we have no shortage of American values. What are they talking about? They're talking about radical values. Now, people would say, well, you know, you're being a little bit extremist yourself. These are not radical values. These are American, in fact, American values. This is what America is all about. Freedom and justice and equality, which, by the way, were themselves considered radical values back in the day. There was to be no freedom and democracy and all that kind of stuff. That was not the vision. That was just a talk. It wasn't a vision. From the very beginning, as you know, the vision was that this would be a country for particular groups of people, a particular group of people. And since they were the founding fathers, since they were the ones to put together the framework, the philosophical framework that would outlast them and several generations after them, and that would stand the test of time, they had to come up with an ironclad philosophy, and they constructed this thing, this way of thinking, this identity. But the identity was not a shared identity. It was never meant to be a shared identity. It was an identity for people of a particular ilk. Now, if anybody wants to debate that point, you are free to do so, but you won't be debating it with me because I wouldn't waste my time discussing that premise. If anybody really wants to convince me that the country was actually founded absolutely in the crucible of justice and equality and freedom and all of those high-minded ideals, and that they pertain to everyone, and that this was not only the belief but the applied philosophy. Well, I will tell you, you will be having a monologue because I won't waste my time talking to somebody who believes that that is true. But if you notice, in this election year, it's been, you know, around. It didn't disappear after the founding fathers. It just transmuted. It went through all kinds of permutations depending on the political, social, and economic climate. But the standing belief, the standing order, has been consistent. This is not a country in which all people are equal. It just isn't. And here's what's interesting. It is not ever meant to be. But we hear this prating, especially in presidential elections. We hear all these concepts bandied around as if, A, the people saying these atrocious things really believe them, and B, they believe that we ought to believe them too. But there's no doubt that in this presidential election year, we have witnessed and continue to witness the rise of the radicalized right. And they're winning. They're winning. Because even the so-called left is talking within the parameters of the discussion that they have going, these falsehoods. They haven't put up any real credible arguments. And I submit, you may disagree, but I believe that the evidence suggests that even the left has taken this bait hook, line, and sinker, because at the root of it, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, there is a kind of acceptance, a universal acceptance, with very, very, very rare exceptions. But there is acceptance of the notion of who is American and who is not. And there also is an acceptance of who is entitled to lead and who is not. There is an acceptance of the philosophy that this country belongs not to everyone. The vision is not to be shared, because the vision is for the benefit of a particular group. Now, that's the radicalized right coming back to life in your face. And we see the thinking becoming more and more dominant in discussions over, say, immigration, healthcare, housing, education. You see these things popping up, these philosophies, these visions of how and for whom this country should work. Who's entitled to stake a claim? Who has access to the throttle and brake of governing and governance? Who has the authority over how the resources of the society, the privileges and the rights, are to be shared? These things were never, ever envisioned to be part of the so-called democratic process. Never. The country was born in the crucible of white supremacy. Also, if anybody wants to argue that, you will be having a monologue. I won't even begin to have a discussion about that. White supremacist thinking basically informed all of America's vision and policies. And it continues to this day. But what has begun, what began, I should say, in the 50s, you know, people say, well, that was the start of the civil rights movement, and you're so wrong if you think so. the civil rights movement was actually a human rights movement and began back in the 1600s when persons of African descent were brought here in chains with the presumption of perpetual free slavery and labor, free labor, in order to provide, to generate and produce and provide the benefits for those in power. If you talk to Native Americans, they'll have an entirely different view about this popular notion that this is the land of democracy and freedom and equality and all that nonsense that people talk about. There are people with long historical memories, and so they have a different point of reference about how this country was formed and what its initial intention was, and why it is necessary that certain things are done, certain visions are created, certain propaganda must be engaged in to maintain the formula. The formula is that one group, and even not all of that group, but a particular sector of that group will do all the thinking and the envisioning and the ruling, and everybody else will follow. And the further down the chain you go, the wider and broader the base, and therefore, the more important it is to have effective mechanisms of control, because the people making the decisions are really numerically outnumbered by those of us at the bottom of the base. But look at what's happening. Look at what's happening in this election year. What are the values being extolled in this election year? And surprisingly, there is no philosophical cleavage really between the Democrats and Republicans, and even the Green Party. I mean, they may differ in one thing or the other, but what is consistent, I'm making a case here, what is consistent is what the vision is, and who's making the vision? Who's crafting the vision? Who is empowered to do so? Who is recognized in the circles of power? And who is not? And why not? That's what's so remarkably consistent about American politics. It never was, and never will be, a true democratic process, even by people who say they're Democrats. Well, let's take a look at how this, or why this has come about, and why we are hearing these radicalized thoughts. We're hearing these radicalized thoughts, these radicalized versions, again, they're being revived to impress us that these, in fact, are American values. And perhaps so. They probably are, when you think about it. Because American values aren't all that great. I mean, the wording is nice, but the actualization of these words has yet to be. And that has remained remarkably consistent since the formation, the official formation of what we now refer to as the United States of America. These American values are being revived because, frankly, there is fear. And it is a primordial fear. It was the fear that existed at the beginning. It is the fear that persists even now. What is that fear? the fear of people who are not white. The fear that whiteness will disappear, and I mean whiteness in its political sense, whiteness as white supremacist thinking, the radicalized right who began this country, posing in some cases as very, very progressive people and visionaries. But I remind you, most of the people signing the Declaration of Independence were slaveholders. And Dr. Gerald Horn on this program discussed that it was fear of the repercussions of the Haitian slave revolt that prompted the elite whites to move quickly against Britain because they feared that Britain would in fact be supported by the Haitians. So hence 1776. Now, what is going to happen? And why are we seeing this revival of radicalized right thinking, even in the bastions of liberalism, even in the progressive, so-called progressive communities? Huh? Because there is a sense of losing ground by virtue of what people so far have understood themselves to be entitled to as white persons in America. The rights and privileges that go along with that. By 2043, according to the U.S. Bureau of the Census, the new minorities, or the new minority, will be people who today have that fear. The new minority as of 2043, and they're saying it might be as early as the late 2030s. The new minority of America will be white. More whites, 80% of deaths are of whites. And the United States is literally losing its whiteness. We have an invasion of people who heretofore, and actually I shouldn't use that word because it still is the case, people who are not desirable because they can infect and cause whiteness to disappear through intermarriage and through assimilation. We heard some years ago, at least two decades ago, the fear was the browning of America. Too many Latinos. And in fact, today, according to the Census Bureau, more than half, of the children being born are being born to Latinos. The African-American community is growing, not nearly as quickly as the Latino community, but the Asian community also is growing. So whiteness as a comfort zone, irrespective of one's political thinking, there is certain comfort in being white in America. That is soon going to come to an end. And the statistics are saying it will come to an end sooner than most people think. What does that mean? It means that the systems of control still have to be handled, you're going to have fewer people who will now have to manage the resources. And I explained many times on this program that democracy has nothing to do with voting. Democracy is about your access, the frequency and quality of access you have to the nation's resources, to the collective resources of our society. Now, if the white community, if we put it that way, if white America is losing ground, and it will definitively lose ground by 2043, if not sooner, that's just around the corner. That's just 3 decades from now, 27 years. If that is going to happen, and it's an inevitability at this point, then you have to move quickly to regain total control, as you've had back in the 1700s and the 1600s. If, in fact, the vision crafted back then was supposed to withstand the test of time, and here we are, and the test of time is here, and time is running out, and the people who historically have had 100% control practically of this country at almost every single level, by virtue of being the minority by 2043, how are they going to function? How are they going to hold on to their positions of power? Well, you see the moves. The moves are being made. Now, whether there are political differences and philosophical differences, I mean, they can deal with that. The thing is, we have to assume that they will, for the most part, agree that white supremacy and white supremacist thinking and white supremacist policy will prevail. You just have to believe that, because that's the way it's worked. And you can't ignore history and fact. Even now, we look at the Democratic Party. And yes, you know, you could say, well, there's Hillary Clinton, and then there is Martin O'Malley, and then there is Bernie Sanders. Okay. But what you should be clear about is that there really isn't a stark difference in this essential philosophy of who ought to be in charge. They don't differ on that at all. Nor do they differ among themselves, nor with the Republicans at all. They all agree. It is agreed. And in service of that, by the way, you look at the so-called non-white candidates in the race, whether on the Republican side or the Democratic side, or there isn't any on the Democratic side. But you look at the candidates on the Republican side, the ones who, by census, would be defined as non-whites, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, they have converted themselves already to indicate to white America, that radicalized right, they are some of the most vigorous people in espousing the philosophy of the radicalized right. They have converted themselves in order to be acceptable. They have deracinated themselves in order to signify to the people, to the constituency out there still operating on that basis, on that norm of the radicalized right philosophy, that they fit in. You can trust them. But we also had that with Barack Obama. Barack Obama was a very, very astute practitioner of this policy. He deracinated himself. And he indicated to the liberal contingent, the so-called liberals, you can trust me because I ain't going to be too black. I do subscribe to... You see what I'm saying? I do subscribe to the philosophy. I am no threat to you or to the understood order. So if you vote for me, blacks now are connected, blacks connected with Obama on the basis, largely, of their historical memory. And out of a sense of racial pride, and related thinking. Whites connected with Obama because he conveyed the exact opposite. He deracinated himself. I am no threat to the standing order. He appealed, therefore, to the people who would say, you know, some of my best friends are black. You see what I mean? This is what we're talking about here. So in this race, 2016, the stakes are very high because literally we are only three decades away from the expected transition that America will be making, in which whites will be the minority. It cannot be turned around. That's inevitable. The stakes are high. And the undercurrent here that these candidates, all of them, are playing to are the coded messages about where they stand with regard to white supremacist thinking that informed the formation of this country. That's my thesis. That's my argument. We're seeing the response at a state level, at a local level, where even the so-called liberals are enacting policies and practicing politics that could only be described as fascistic in nature. The urban centers of America, that's the polite way of saying the places where you would find most blacks and Latinos living, have some of the most retrograde politics that you could imagine. And it is linked to, in my view, a consciousness that the charge of those in leadership is to protect a system, first and foremost. And the system is that white supremacist system that we have been living with formally since 1776, but since the 1600s. And that is why we have to interpret this time, this political era, as a kind of reordering of priorities, a reshuffling of the deck, because they must do everything possible to protect a system that is essentially racist in nature, because that is the formula that has worked and that must continue to work if the standard American value, which is that whites are to be in charge of almost everything, if that also is to work. So we're not talking here about the running for president and who's going to be in the White House. No, we are looking, we should be thinking, the contest is to see who the next
restored will be of the system. Because there essentially is no argument there, no matter where these candidates fall on the political spectrum. They do not disagree as to who should be in charge. Nor do they disagree as to who ought to be controlled. They don't. That's why a Bernie Sanders, who describes himself as a democratic socialist, has no problem with approving war, has no problem waging war on a non-white country. And Hillary Clinton, we just discussed her yesterday. Hillary Clinton is so ambitious, she actually was president of a country before she vied for a presidency of the United States. She was president of Haiti by proxy. No problem going to Haiti, causing all kinds of calamities there. In fact, torpedoing the ascendancy of a woman who was in line and was doing very well in the contest for president of Haiti, personally installed the president she wanted. Because the thinking is, I can do that. I could do that. It's within my power to do that. And so I did it. It's not that it's not known, but it's not even an issue in this presidential race. You could do whatever you want to do in Haiti. It's all right. And people think of her and she tells you, I'm a strong person. She had said she has no problems at all nuking Iran. No problem. Madeleine Albright, her predecessor as Secretary of State, said she basically had no problem with hundreds of thousands of children, half a million children or so, being killed by U.S. bombs, because in the end, it was for their own good, and she could live with that. So the thinking is consistent, very fascistic, very white supremacist. Sometimes it wears lipstick and a pantsuit, and sometimes it is as crude as Donald Trump. Sometimes it's evangelical, like Ted Cruz, and sometimes it's benign, like Ben Carson, and deracinated, like Ben Carson and Barack Obama. But it is the same thinking. So we are in a moment where we have to kind of broaden our view a bit and see that this is not just an election. What is at stake here is America's own sense of itself. And America's sense of self, crafted in the crucible of white supremacy, it is insane to believe that that essential sense of self will somehow just go away, and people will see the incredible beauty of embracing all persons. No, that doesn't happen. It just is talk. Go by history and go by the facts. But we are, in historical time, literally at the brink of a cataclysmic, a seismic change in America, having to do with the group that historically has been in charge of everything, losing ground numerically, and that is triggering a revival of the primordial fears that informed their decisions and their policies from the word go. That's what this election is. It's not about the Democrats and the Republicans, and you throw in the Green Party and other splinter groups for color, pardon the pun. It's not about that at all. But it is necessary for us to think that that's what it is, because if we actually focus on what it is, it will destroy everything. If we actually act like we are hip to what's happening, they'll be done for. So we are encouraged to get immersed in the trivial and embarrassing 2016 presidential campaign as a diversionary tactic. They know what this is all about. It's about who's controlling the system. And we, the so-called American people, that is, they keep inventing things that simply do not exist. The American people, who are those? I don't know the American people. I know that this is one of the most fractured and fragmented societies that you could find on the planet. And by design. That was the initial design. That remains the consistent design. There is going to be no American people. Now, I painted a picture of doom, one might say. But I also am hopeful. I'm hopeful that people get it. And get it soon. Because, as a matter of fact, if only for a numerical advantage, this is a time to change our way of thinking. What do we do? How do we leverage a numerical advantage here? How do we do that? What do we do with a numerical advantage? I have given up entirely. Well, I take that back. Almost entirely on this business of converting white supremacists into thinking differently. I don't see any point to that. There isn't enough time. There isn't enough energy. And in any event, it's not my job. It is not my job or anybody else's job except white supremacists to save them from themselves. It's not my job to go save a system. It's not my job to teach people how to be human. That's not my job. The job that I have, this is my unique personal point of view, the job I have is to survive and to teach others similarly situated to share with them what they need to know in order to survive, to explain the system, to help craft alternative systems. I'm not going out there to save anybody. That's your job. And I'm not waiting for some grand epiphany to occur and everybody, you know, a beam of light will descend from the heavens and people will see the error of their ways and they would learn to love people. I'm not interested in that. That's a figment of somebody's imagination. It ain't mine. I see an urgency long in the making, but an urgency to get really grounded in the reality that we are experiencing. To understand what is happening, to see how things are connected, but for a particular purpose. To not accept things literally, but to operate with your own plan, your own response, your own counteroffensive because it is going to get much worse. And it's going to get much worse because the fears are going to be greater and greater as we approach 2043. The fascistic fervor that is existing now is going to intensify. The policies coming out of that fascistic fervor will be to our detriment. So you can't wait. And you can't expect people to work to your advantage. This is also a misnomer here in the United States, that if we all join together, we will all benefit. The so-called civil rights struggle told us that. Everybody pretty much benefited except the people who bore the brunt of the suffering. Just about everybody benefited. It's a bad habit, and we've got to stop it. You vote your interests, but first you understand your interests. You get to know your interests, and you get to understand that a system has to be constructed to counter the system that is already in place and that is determined, is designed to withstand the test of time. Now, in this time that we're in, it should occur to those people who see what is happening that it is also to their benefit to get realigned and to recognize, even within the progressive and liberal and left of center communities, the same flaw and to oppose it. But that takes courage. It takes tenacity, and it takes a genuine interest in the whole concept of communal action. It's possible, but it really is a challenge. But that's their job. That's for them to do. For the people who are going to be in the crosshairs of what's coming, my charge to you is to wake up and look at what it is you're dealing with. Don't have people play with your brains. They're peeing all over you and telling you it's raining. Wake up and fashion an approach that at some point would guarantee, if not guarantee, would at least shore up your chances of survival. So I leave you with those thoughts today. A way of looking at 2016, not as an event, a presidential election, but more as a continuum of America's less than stellar history, racial history, and as a point to redefine how we approach the next leg of the race, because 2043 is coming. And in some cases, it is already here. The more fear we have from the empowered white supremacist sectors of America, the worse it's going to be for the rest of us. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. Let me know what you think of this program today. Send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, I thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company. We'll see each other tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday. Get your brains together. Bye-bye.